Chapter 16. You crossed the water, left me ashore. It killed me enough, but you wanted more. You blew up the bridge. A mad terrorist waved from your side, threw me a kiss. I started to follow, but realized too late. There was nothing but air underneath my feet. Bridge. Collateral damage, track 4. Fingers of light are starting to pry open the night sky. Soon the sun will rise, and a new day will inarguably begin. A day in which I'm leaving for London, and Mia for Tokyo. I feel the countdown of the clock ticking like a time bomb. We're on the Brooklyn Bridge now, and though Mia hasn't said so specifically, I feel like this must be the last stop. I mean, we're leaving Manhattan, and not a round trip like our cruise out to Staten Island and back was. And also, Mia has decided, I guess, that since she's pulled some confessionals, it's my turn. About halfway across the bridge, she stops suddenly and turns to me.
"So what's up with you and the band?"
she asks. There's a warm wind blowing, but I suddenly feel cold. "What do you mean, what's up?" Mia shrugs.
"Something's up. I can tell. You've hardly talked about them all night. You guys used to be inseparable, and now you don't even live in the same state. And why didn't you go to London together?"
"I told you, logistics."
"What was so important that they couldn't have waited one night for you?"
"I had to do some stuff. Go into the studio and lay down a few guitar tracks." Mia eyes me skeptically.
"But you're on tour for a new album. Why are you even recording?"
"A promo version of one of our singles. More of this," I say, frowning as I rub my fingers together in a money-money motion.
"But wouldn't you be recording together?"
I shake my head. "It doesn't really work like that anymore. And besides, I had to do an interview with Shuffle."
"An interview? Not with the band, just with you? That's what I don't get."
I think back to the day before, to Vanessa LeGrand, and out of the blue I'm recalling the lyrics to Bridge, and wondering if maybe discussing this with Mia Hall above the dark waters of the East River isn't such a hot idea. At least it isn't Friday the 13th anymore.
"Yeah, that's kind of how it works these days, too," I say. "Why do they only want just you? What do they want to know about?"
I really don't want to talk about this, but Mia's like a bloodhound, tracking a scent, and I know her well enough to know that I can either throw her a piece of bloody meat or let her sniff her way to the real pile of stinking corpses. I go for the diversion. "Actually, that part's kind of interesting. The reporter, she asked about you."
"What?"
Mia swivels around to face me. "She was interviewing me and asked about you. About us. About high school." The look of shock on Mia's face, I savor it. I think about what she said earlier, about her life in Oregon being a lifetime ago. Well, maybe not such a lifetime ago. That's the first time that's happened. Kind of strange coincidence, all things considered.
"I don't believe in coincidences anymore."
I didn't tell her anything, but she'd gotten a hold of the old Cougar yearbook. The one with our picture, Groovy and the Geek. Mia shakes her head.
"Yeah, I so love that nickname."
"Don't worry, I didn't say anything. And for good measure, I smashed her recorder, destroyed all evidence."
"Not all the evidence," she stares at me. "The Cougar lives on. I'm sure Kim will be delighted to know her early work may turn up in a national magazine."
She shakes her head and chuckles.
"Once Kim gets you in her shutter, you're stuck forever. So it was pointless to destroy that reporter's recorder."
"I know. I just sort of lost it. She was this very provocative person, and she was trying to get a rise out of me with all these insults disguised as compliments." Mia nods knowingly.
"I get that, too. It's the worst. I was fascinated by the Shostakovich you played tonight. So much more subdued than the Bach,"
she says in a snooty voice.
"Translation, the Shostakovich sucked."
I can't imagine the Shostakovich ever sucking, but I won't deny us this common ground.
"So what did she want to know about me?"
"She had plans to do this big expose, I guess, on what makes Shooting Star tick. And she went digging around our hometown and talked to people we went to high school with, and they told her about us. About what we were. And about you and what happened." I trail off. I look down at the river, at a passing barge, which, judging by its smell, is carrying garbage.
"And what really happened?"
Mia asks.
I'm not sure if this is a rhetorical question, so I force my own voice into a jokey drawl.
Yeah, that's what I'm still trying to figure out.
It occurs to me that this is maybe the most honest thing I've said all night, but the way I've said it transforms it into a lie. You know, my manager warned me that the accident might get a lot of attention as my profile went up, but I didn't think that the connection to you would be an issue. I mean, I did in the beginning. I sort of waited for someone to look me up, ghosts of girlfriends past, but I guess I wasn't interesting enough compared to your other, attachments.
She thinks that's why none of the hacks have pestered her, because she's not as interesting as Bryn, who I guess she does know about.
If only she knew how the band's inner circle has bent over backward to keep her name out of things, to not touch the bruise that blooms at the mere mention of her. That right at this very moment, there are riders in interview contracts that dictate whole swaths of forbidden conversational topics that, though they don't name her specifically, are all about obliterating her from the record, protecting her and me.
I guess high school really is ancient history, she concludes.
Ancient history? Have you really relegated us to the trash heap of the dumb high school romance? And if that's the case, why the hell can't I do the same?
Yeah, well, you plus me, we're like MTV plus Lifetime, I say, with as much jauntiness as I can muster. In other words, shark bait.
She sighs.
Oh, well, I suppose even sharks have to eat.
What's that supposed to mean?
It's just, I don't particularly want my family history dragged through the public eye, but if that's the price to be paid for doing what you love, I guess I'll pay it.
And we're back to this. The notion that music can make it all worthwhile. I'd like to believe. I just don't. I'm not even sure that I ever did. It isn't the music that makes me want to wake up every day and take another breath. I turn away from her toward the dark water below.
What if it's not what you love? I mumble, but my voice gets lost in the wind and the traffic.
But at least I've said it out loud. I've done that much. I need a cigarette. I lean against the railing and look uptown toward a trio of bridges. Mia comes to stand beside me as I'm fumbling to get my lighter to work.
You should quit,
she says, touching me gently on the shoulder. For a second, I think she means the band, that she heard what I said before and is telling me to quit Shooting Star, leave the whole music industry. I keep waiting for someone to advise me to quit the music business, but no one ever does. Then I remember how earlier tonight she told me the same thing, right before she bummed a cigarette. It's not so easy, I say.
Bullshit,
Mia says, with a self-righteousness that instantly recalls her mother, Kat, who wore her certitude like a beat-up leather jacket and who had a mouth on her that could make a roadie blush.
Quitting's not hard. Deciding to quit is hard. Once you make that mental leap, the rest is easy.
Really? Was that how you quit me? And just like that, without thinking. Without saying it in my head first, without arguing with myself for days, it's out there.
So, she says, as if speaking to an audience under the bridge, he finally says it.
Was I not supposed to? Am I just supposed to let this whole night go without talking about what you did?
No,
she says softly. So why? Why did you go? Was it because of the voices? She shakes her head.
It wasn't the voices.
Then what? What was it? I hear the desperation in my own voice now.
It was lots of things, like how you couldn't be yourself around me.
What are you talking about?
You stopped talking to me.
That's absurd, Mia. I talk to you all the time.
You talked to me, but you didn't. I could see you having these two-sided conversations, the things you wanted to say to me, and the words that actually came out.
I think of all the dual conversations I have. With everyone. Is that when it started?
Well, you weren't exactly easy to talk to, I shoot back. Anything I said was the wrong thing.
She looks at me with a sad smile.
I know. It wasn't just you. It was you plus me. It was us.
I just shake my head. It's not true.
Yes, it is. But don't feel bad. Everyone walked on eggshells around me. But with you, it was painful that you couldn't be real with me. I mean, you barely even touched me.
As if to reinforce the point, she places two fingers on the inside of my wrist.
were smoke to rise and the imprints of her two fingers branded onto me, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. I have to pull away just to steady myself.
"You were healing," is my pathetic reply. "And if I recall, when we did try, you freaked."
"Once," she says.
"Once.
All I wanted was for you to be okay. All I wanted was to help you. I would have done anything."
She drops her chin to her chest.
"Yes, I know. You wanted to rescue me."
"Damn, Mia, you say that like it's a bad thing."
She looks up at me. The sympathy is still in her eyes, but there's something else now, too. A fierceness. It slices up my anger and reconstitutes it as dread.
"You were so busy trying to be my savior that you left me all alone," she says. "I know you were trying to help, but it just felt, at the time, like you were pushing me away, keeping things from me for my own good and making me more of a victim. Ernesto says that people's good intentions can wind up putting us in boxes as confining as coffins."
"Ernesto? What the hell does he know about it?"
Mia traces the gap between the wooden boardwalk planks with her toe.
"A lot, actually. His parents were killed when he was 8. He was raised by his grandparents."
I know what I'm supposed to feel is sympathy, but the rage just washes over me.
"What? Is there some club?"
I ask, my voice starting to crack.
"A grief club that I can't join?"
I expect her to tell me no, or that I'm a member. After all, I lost them too. Except even back then, it had been different, like there'd been a barrier. That's the thing you never expect about grieving, what a competition it is. Because no matter how important they'd been to me, no matter how sorry people told me they were, Denny and Kat and Teddy weren't my family, and suddenly that distinction had mattered. Apparently it still does, because Mia stops and considers my question.
"Maybe not a grief club, but a guilt club, from being left behind."
Oh, don't talk to me about guilt. My blood runs thick with it. On the bridge, now I feel tears coming. The only way to keep them at bay is to find the anger that sustained me and push back with it.
"But you could have at least told me,"
I say, my voice rising to a shout.
"Instead of dropping me like a one-night stand, you could have had the decency to break up with me instead of leaving me wondering for 3 years.
"I didn't plan it,"
she says, her own pitch rising.
"I didn't get on that plane thinking we'd split up. You were everything to me. Even as it was happening, I didn't believe it was happening. But it was. Just being here, being away. It was all so much easier in a way I didn't anticipate. In a way I didn't think my life could be anymore. It was a huge relief."
I think of all the girls whose backs I couldn't wait to see in retreat. How once their sound and smell and voices were gone, I felt my whole body exhale. A lot of the time, Bryn falls into this category. That's how my absence felt to Mia.
"I planned to tell you,"
she continues, the words coming out in a breathless jumble now.
"But at first I was so confused. I didn't even know what was happening, only that I was feeling better without you. And how could I explain that to you? And then time went by. You didn't call me. When you didn't pursue it, I just figured that you of all people, you understood. I knew I was being a chicken shit, but I thought..."
Mia stumbles for a second, then regains her composure.
"I thought I was allowed that. And that you understood it. I mean, you seem to. You wrote, 'She says I have to pick, choose you or choose me. She's the last one standing.' I don't know. When I heard roulette, I just thought you did understand. That you were angry, but you knew. I had to choose me."
"That's your excuse for dropping me without a word? There's cowardly Mia, and then there's cruel. Is that who you've become?"
"Maybe it was who I needed to be for a while," she cries. "And I'm sorry. I know I should have contacted you, should have explained, but you weren't all that accessible."
"Oh, bullshit, Mia. I'm inaccessible to most people, but you? 2 phone calls and you could have tracked me down."
"It didn't feel that way,"
she said.
"You were this..."
She trails off, miming an explosion, the same as Vanessa LeGrand had done earlier in the day.
"Phenomenon. Not a person anymore.
That's such a load of crap and you should know it. And besides, that was more than a year after you left. A year!
A year in which I was curled up into a ball of misery at my parents' house, Mia. Or did you forget that phone number, too?
No. Mia's voice is flat. But I couldn't call you at first.
Why?
I yell.
Why not?
Mia faces me now. The wind is whipping her hair this way and that, so she looks like some kind of mystical sorceress. Beautiful, powerful, and scary at the same time. She shakes her head and starts to turn away.
Oh no, we've come this far over the bridge. She can blow the damn thing up if she wants to, but not without telling me everything.
I grab her, turn her to face me.
Why not? Tell me, you owe me this!
She looks at me, square in the eye, taking aim, and then she pulls the trigger.
Because I hated you.
The wind, the noise, it all just goes quiet for a second. And I'm left with a dull ringing in my ear, like after a show, like after a heart monitor goes to flatline.
Hated me? Why?
You made me stay. She says it quietly, and it almost gets lost in the wind and the traffic, and I'm not sure I heard her. But then she repeats it louder this time.
You made me stay.
And there it is. A hollow blown through my heart, confirming what some part of me has always known.
She knows.
The electricity in the air has changed. It's like you can smell the ions dancing.
I still wake up every single morning, and for a second I forget that I don't have my family anymore,
she tells me.
And then I remember. Do you know what that's like? Over and over again? It would have been so much easier.
And suddenly her calm facade cracks, and she begins to cry.
Please,
I hold up my hands.
Please don't. No, you're right. You have to let me say this, Adam. You have to hear it. It would have been easier to die. It's not that I want to be dead now. I don't. I have a lot in my life that I get satisfaction from, that I love. But some days, especially in the beginning, it was so hard. And I couldn't help but think that it would have been so much simpler to go with the rest of them. But you asked me to stay. You begged me to stay. You stood over me and you made a promise to me as sacred as any vow. And I can understand why you're angry, but you can't blame me. You can't hate me for taking your word.
Mia's sobbing now. I'm racked with shame because I brought her to this. And suddenly, I get it. I understand why she summoned me to her at the theater. Why she came after me once I left her dressing room. This is what the farewell tour is really all about. Mia completing the severance she began 3 years ago. Letting go. Everyone talks about it like it's the easiest thing. Unfurl your fingers one by one until your hand is open. But my hand has been clenched into a fist for 3 years now. It's frozen shut. All of me is frozen shut and about to shut down completely. I stare down at the water. A minute ago it was calm and glassy, but now it's like the river is opening up, churning. Violent whirlpool. It's that vortex, threatening to swallow me whole. I'm going to drown in it, with nobody. Nobody in the murk with me. I've blamed her for all of this, for leaving, for ruining me. Maybe that was the seed of it, but from that one little seed grew this tumor of a flowering plant. And I'm the one who nurtures it. I water it. I care for it. I nibble from its poison berries. I let it wrap around my neck, choking the air right out of me. I've done that. All by myself. All to myself. I look at the river. It's like the waves are 50 feet high, snapping at me now, trying to pull me over the bridge into the waters below.
I can't do this anymore!
I yell as the carnivorous waves come for me. Again, I scream.
I can't do this anymore!
I'm yelling to the waves and to Liz and Fitzy and Mike and Aldous, to our record executives and to Bryn and Vanessa and the paparazzi and the girls in the U-Mish sweatshirts and the scenesters on the subway and everyone who wants a piece of me when there aren't enough pieces to go around. But mostly, I'm yelling it to myself.
I can't do this anymore!
I scream louder than I've ever screamed in my life. So loud my breath is knocking down trees in Manhattan, I'm sure of it.
And as I battle with invisible waves and imaginary vortexes and demons that are all too real and of my own making, I actually feel something in my chest open. A feeling so intense, it's like my heart's about to burst. And I just let it. I just let it out. When I look up, the river is a river again. My hands, which had been gripping the railing of the bridge so tight that my knuckles had gone white, have loosened. Mia is walking away, walking toward the other end of the bridge, without me. I get it now. I have to make good on my promise, to let her go, to really let her go, to let us both go. Chapter 17. I started playing in my first band, Infinity 89, when I was 14 years old. Our first show was at a house party near the college campus. All three of us in the band, me on guitar, my friend Nate on bass, and his older brother Jonah on drums, sucked. None of us had been playing for long, and after the gig, we found out that Jonah had bribed the host of the party to let us play. It's a little-known fact that Adam Wilde's first foray into playing rock music in front of an audience might never have happened had Jonah Hamilton not pitched in for a keg. The keg turned out to be the best thing about that show. We were so nervous that we turned the amps up too loud, creating a frenzy of feedback that made the neighbors complain, and then we overcompensated by playing so low that we couldn't hear one another's instruments. What I could hear in the pauses between songs was the sound of the party. The din of beer bottles clinking, of mindless chatter, of people laughing, and I swear, in the back room of the house, people watching American Idol. The point is, I could hear all this because our band was so crappy that no one bothered to acknowledge that we were playing. We weren't worth cheering. We were too bad to even boo. We were simply ignored. When we finished playing, the party carried on as if we'd never gone on. We got better. Never great, but better. Never good enough to play anything but house parties. Then Jonah went off to college, and Nate and I were left without a drummer, and that was the end of Infinity 89. Thus began my brief stint as a lone singer-songwriter about town, playing in coffee houses mostly. Doing the cafe circuit was marginally better than the house parties. With just me and a guitar, I didn't need to up the volume that much, and people in the audience were mostly respectful. But as I played, I was still distracted by the sounds of things other than the music. The hiss of the cappuccino maker, the intellectual college students' hushed conversations about important things, the giggles of girls. After the show, the giggles grew louder as the girls came up to me to talk, to ask me about my inspiration, to offer me mixed CDs they'd made, and sometimes to offer other things. One girl was different. She had ropey, muscled arms and a fierce look in her eyes. The first time she spoke to me, she said only, "You're wasted." "Nope. Sober as a stone," I replied. "Not that kind of wasted," she said, arching her pierced eyebrow. "You're wasted on acoustic. I saw you play before in that terrible band of yours, but you were really good, even for a child such as yourself." "Thanks, I think." "You're welcome. I'm not here for flattery. I'm here for recruitment." "Sorry, I'm a pacifist." "Funny. I'm a dyke, one who likes to ask and tell. So, I'm also ill-suited for the military. No, I'm putting together a band. I think you're an outrageously talented guitar player, so I'm here to rob the cradle, artistically speaking." I was barely 16 years old and a little bit intimidated by this ballsy chick, but I'd said, why not? "Who else is in the band?" "Me on drums, you on guitar." "And?" "Those are the most important parts, don't you think? Fantastic drummers and singing guitar players don't grow on trees, not even in Oregon. Don't worry, I'll fill in the blanks. I'm Liz, by the way." She stuck out her hand. It was crusted with calluses, always a good sign on a drummer. Within a month, Liz had drafted Fitzy and Mike, and we'd christened ourselves Shooting Star and started writing songs together. A month after that, we had our first gig. It was another house party, but nothing like the ones I'd played with Infinity 89. Right from the get-go, something was different. When I slashed out my first chord, it was like turning off a light. Everything just fell silent. We had people's attention, and we kept it. In the empty space between songs, people cheered and then got quiet, anticipating our next song. Over time, they'd start shouting requests. After a while, they got to know our lyrics so well that they'd sing along, which was handy when I spaced a lyric. Pretty soon, we moved on to playing in bigger clubs. I could sometimes make out bar sounds in the background, the clink of glasses, the shouts of orders to a bartender. I also started to hear people scream my name for the first time. Adam! Over here! A lot of those voices belonged to girls. The girls I mostly ignored. At this point, I'd started obsessing about a girl who never came to our shows, but who I'd seen playing cello at school. And when Mia had become my girlfriend, and then started coming to my shows, and, to my surprise, seemed to actually enjoy, if not the gigs, then at least our music, I sometimes listened for her. I wanted to hear her voice calling out my name, even though I knew that was something she'd never do. She was a reluctant plus one. She tended to hang backstage and watch me with a solemn intensity. Even when she loosened up enough to sometimes watch the show like a normal person from the audience, she remained pretty reserved. But still, I listened for the sound of her voice. It never seemed to matter that I didn't hear it. Listening for her was half the fun. As the band got bigger and the shows got bigger, the cheers just grew louder. And then for a while, it all went quiet. There was no music, no band, no fans, no Mia. When it came back, the music, the gigs, the crowds, it all sounded different. Even during that two-week tour right on the heels of Collateral Damage's release, I could tell how much had changed just by how different everything sounded. The wall of sound as we played enveloped the band, almost as if we were playing in a bubble made of nothing other than our own noise. And in between the songs, there was this screaming and shrieking. Soon, much sooner than I ever could have imagined, we were playing these enormous venues, arenas and stadiums, to more than 15,000 fans. At these venues, there are just so many people and so much sound that it's almost impossible to differentiate a specific voice. All I hear, aside from our own instruments now blaring out of the most powerful speakers available, is that wild scream from the crowd when we're backstage and the lights go down right before we go out. And once we're on stage, the constant shrieking of the crowd melds so it sounds like the furious howl of a hurricane. Some nights I swear I can feel the breath of those 15,000 screams. I don't like this sound. I find the monolithic nature of it disorienting. For a few gigs, we traded our wedge monitors for in-ear pieces. It was perfect sound, as though we were in the studio, the roar of the crowd blocked off. But that was even worse in a way. I feel so disconnected from the crowds as it is, by the distance between them and us, a distance separated by a vast expanse of stage and an army of security keeping fans from bounding up to touch us or stage dive the way they used to. But more than that, I don't like that it's so hard to hear any one single voice break through. I don't know. Maybe I'm still listening for that one voice. Every so often during a show, though, as me or Mike pause to retune our guitars or someone takes a swig from a bottle of water, I'll pause and strain to pick out a voice from the crowd. And every so often I can hear someone shouting for a specific song or screaming I love you or chanting my name. As I stand here on the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm thinking about those stadium shows, of their hurricane wail of white noise, because all I can hear now is a roaring in my head. A wordless howl as Mia disappears and I try to let her. But there's something else too. A small voice trying to break through, to puncture the roar of nothingness. And the voice grows stronger and stronger, and it's my voice this time, and it's asking a question. How does she know? Chapter 18. Are you happy in your misery? Resting peaceful in desolation? It's the final tie that binds us, the sole source of my consolation. Blue, Collateral Damage, track 6. Mia's gone. The bridge looks like a ghost ship from another time, even as it fills up with the most 21st century kind of people, early morning joggers. And me, alone again. But I'm still standing. I'm still breathing. And somehow, I'm okay. But still the question is gaining momentum and volume. How does she know? Because I never told anyone what I asked of her. Not the nurses, not the grandparents, not Kim, and not Mia. So how does she know? If you stay, I'll do whatever you want. I'll quit the band, go with you to New York. But if you need me to go away,
I'll do that, too. Maybe coming back to your old life would just be too painful. Maybe it'd be easier for you to erase us. And that would suck, but I'd do it. I can lose you like that if I don't lose you today. I'll let you go. If you stay. That was my vow. And it's been my secret, my burden, my shame, that I asked her to stay, that she listened. Because after I promised her what I promised her, and played her a Yo-Yo Ma cello piece, it had seemed as if she had heard. She'd squeezed my hand, and I'd thought it was going to be like in the movies, but all she'd done was squeeze, and stayed unconscious. But that squeeze had turned out to be her first voluntary muscle movement. It was followed by more squeezes, then by her eyes opening for a flutter or two, and then longer. One of the nurses had explained that Mia's brain was like a baby bird trying to poke its way out of an eggshell, and that squeeze was the beginning of an emergence that went on for a few days until she woke up and asked for water. Whenever she talked about the accident, Mia said the entire week was a blur. She didn't remember a thing. And I wasn't about to tell her about the promise I'd made, a promise that, in the end, I was forced to keep. But she knew. No wonder she hates me. In a weird way, it's a relief. I'm so tired of carrying this secret around. I'm so tired of feeling bad for making her live and feeling angry at her for living without me and feeling like a hypocrite for the whole mess. I stand there on the bridge for a while, letting her get away, and then I walk the remaining few hundred feet to the ramp down. I've seen dozens of taxis pass by on the roadway below, so even though I have no clue where I am, I'm pretty sure I'll find a cab to bring me back to my hotel. But when I get down the ramp, I'm in a plaza area, not where the car traffic lets out. I flag down a jogger, a middle-aged guy, chugging off the bridge, and ask where I can get a taxi, and he points me toward a bunch of buildings. There's usually a queue on weekdays. I don't know about weekends, but I'm sure you'll find a cab somewhere. He's wearing an iPod and has pulled out the earbuds to talk to me, but the music is still playing, and it's Fugazi. The guy's running to Fugazi, the very tail end of Smallpox Champion. Then the song clicks over and it's Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones. And the music, it's like, I don't know, fresh bread on an empty stomach, or a wood stove on a frigid day. It's reaching out of the earbuds and beckoning me. The guy keeps looking at me. "Are you Adam Wilde, from Shooting Star?" he asks. Not at all fan-like, just curious. It takes a lot of effort to stop listening to the music and give him my attention. "Yeah." I reach out my hand. "I don't mean to be rude," he says after we shake. "But what are you doing walking around Brooklyn at 6:30 on a Saturday morning? Are you lost or something?" "No, I'm not lost. Not anymore, anyway." Mick Jagger is crooning away, and I practically have to bite my lip to keep from singing along. It used to be I never went anywhere without my tunes. And then it was like everything else, take it or leave it. But now I'll take it. Now I need it. "Can I ask you for an insanely huge and just plain insane favor?" I ask. "Okay. Can I borrow your iPod, just for the day? If you give me your name and address, I'll have it messengered over to you. I promise you'll have it back by tomorrow's run." He shakes his head, laughs. "One butt crack of dawn run a weekend is enough for me. But yeah, you can borrow it. The buzzer on my building doesn't work, so just deliver it to Nick at the Southside Cafe on 6th Avenue in Brooklyn. I'm in there every morning." "Nick, Southside Cafe, 6th Avenue, Brooklyn. I won't forget, I promise." "I believe you," he says, spooling the wires. "I'm afraid you won't find any Shooting Star on there." "Better yet, I'll have this back to you by tonight." "Don't worry about it," he says. "Battery was fully charged when I left, so you should be good for at least an hour. The thing's a dinosaur," he chuckles softly. Then he takes off running, tossing a wave at me without looking back. I plug myself into the iPod. It's truly battered. I make a note to get him a new one when I return this one. I scroll through his collection, everything from Charlie Parker to Minutemen to Yola Tango. He's got all these playlists. I choose one titled Good Songs. And when the piano riff at the start of the new Pornographer's Challengers kicks in, I know I've put myself in good hands. Next up is some Andrew Bird, followed by a kick-ass Billy Bragg and Wilco song I haven't heard in years. and then Sufjan Stevens' Chicago, which is a song I used to love but had to stop listening to because it always made me feel too stirred up. But now, it's just right. It's like a cool bath after a fever sweat, helping to soothe the itch of all those unanswerable questions I just can't be tormenting myself with anymore. I spin the volume up all the way, so it's blasting even my battle-worn eardrums. That, along with the racket of downtown Brooklyn waking up, metal grates grinding and buses chugging, is pretty damn loud. So when a voice pierces the din, I almost don't hear it. But there it is. The voice I've been listening for all these years.
Adam!
It screams. I don't believe it at first. I turn off Sufjan. I look around. And then there she is, in front of me now. Her face streaked with tears, saying my name again like it's the first word I've ever heard. I let go. I truly did. But there she is, right in front of me.
I thought I'd lost you. I went back and looked for you on the bridge, but I didn't see you, and I figured you'd walk back to the Manhattan side, and I got this dumb idea that I could beat you over in a cab and ambush you on the other side. I know this is selfish. I heard what you said up there on the bridge, but we can't leave it like that. I can't. Not again. We have to say goodbye differently. Bet.
Mia? I interrupt. My voice is a question mark and a caress. It stops her babbling cold.
How did you know?
The question is out of the blue, yet she seems to know exactly what I'm asking about.
Oh, that, she says. That's complicated.
I start to back away from her. I have no right to ask her, and she isn't under any obligation to tell me. It's okay. We're good now. I'm good now.
No, Adam, stop,
Mia says. I stop.
I want to tell you. I need to tell you everything. I just think I need some coffee before I can get it together enough to explain.
She leads me out of downtown, into a historic district, to a bakery on a cobblestone street. Its windows are darkened, the door locked. By all signs, the place is closed. But Mia knocks, and within a minute, a bushy-haired man with flour clinging to his unruly beard swings open the door and shouts bonjour to Mia and kisses her on both cheeks. Mia introduces me to Hassan, who disappears into the bakery, leaving the door open so that the warm aroma of butter and vanilla waft into the morning air. He returns with two large cups of coffee and a brown paper bag, already staining dark with butter. She hands me my coffee, and I open it to see it's steaming and black, just like I like it. It's morning now. We find a bench on the Brooklyn Heights promenade, another one of Mia's favorite New York spots, she tells me. It's right on the East River, with Manhattan so close you can almost touch it. We sit in companionable silence, sipping our coffee, eating Hassan's still warm croissants. And it feels so good. So like old times that part of me would like to just click a magic stopwatch, exist in this moment forever. Except there are no magic stopwatches, and there are questions that need to be answered. Mia, however, seems in no rush. She sips, she chews, she looks out at the city. Finally, when she's drained her coffee, she turns to me.
I didn't lie before when I said I didn't remember anything about the accident or after, she begins. But then, I did start remembering things. Not exactly remembering, but hearing details of things and having them feel intensely familiar. I told myself it was because I'd heard the stories over and over, but that wasn't it. Fast forward about a year and a half. I'm on my 7th or 8th therapist.
So you are in therapy?
She gives me a cockeyed look. Of course I am. I used to go through shrinks like shoes. They all told me the same thing.
Which is?
That I was angry. That I was angry the accident happened. That I was angry I was the only survivor. That I was angry at you.
She turns to me with an apologetic grimace.
The other stuff all made sense. But you, I didn't get. I mean, why you? But I was. I could feel how...
She trails off for a second.
Furious I was.
She finishes quietly.
There were all the obvious reasons how you withdrew from me, how much the accident changed us.
but it didn't add up to this lethal fury I suddenly felt once I got away. I think really, somewhere in me, I must have known all along that you asked me to stay, way before I actually remembered it. Does that make any sense?
No. Yes. I don't know. None of this makes sense, I say.
I know. So I was angry with you. I didn't know why. I was angry with the world. I did know why. I hated all my therapists for being useless. I was this little ball of self-destructive fury, and none of them could do anything but tell me that I was a little ball of self-destructive fury. Until I found Nancy, not one of them helped me as much as my Juilliard profs did. I mean, hello, I knew I was angry. Tell me what to do with the anger, please. Anyhow, Ernesto suggested hypnotherapy. It helped him quit smoking, I guess.
She elbows me in the ribs. Of course Mr. Perfect wouldn't smoke, and of course he'd be the one who helped Mia unearth the reason she hates me.
It was kind of risky, Mia continues. Hypnosis tends to unlock hidden memories. Some trauma is just too much for the conscious mind to handle, and you have to go in through a back door to access it. So I reluctantly submitted to a few sessions. It wasn't what I thought it would be. No swinging amulet, no metronome. It was more like those guided imagery exercises they'd sometimes have us do at camp. At first, nothing happened. And then I went to Vermont for the summer and quit. But a few weeks later, I started to get these flashes. Random flashes. Like I could remember a surgery, could actually hear the specific music the doctors played in the operating room. I thought about calling them to ask if what I remembered was true, but so much time had passed, I doubted they'd remember. Besides, I didn't really feel like I needed to ask them. My dad used to say that when I was born, I looked so totally familiar to him. He was overwhelmed with this feeling that he'd known me all his life, which was funny considering how little I looked like him or Mom. But when I had my first memories, I felt that same certainty, that they were real and mine. I didn't put the pieces together fully until I was working on a cello piece. A lot of memories seem to hit when I'm playing. Anyhow, it was Gershwin. Andante con moto e poco rubato.
I open my mouth to say something, but at first nothing comes out. I played you that, I finally say.
I know.
She doesn't seem surprised by my confirmation. I lean forward, put my head between my knees, and take deep breaths. I feel Mia's hand gently touch the back of my neck.
Adam?
Her voice is tentative.
There's more. And here's where it gets a little freaky. It makes a certain sense to me that my mind somehow recorded the things that were happening around my body while I was unconscious. But there are other things. Other memories.
Like what? My voice is a whisper.
Most of it is hazy, but I have certain strong memories of things I couldn't know because I wasn't there. I have this one memory. It's of you. It's dark out, and you're standing outside the hospital entrance under the floodlights, waiting to come see me. You're wearing your leather jacket and looking up, like you're looking for me. Did you do that?
Mia cups my chin up and lifts my face, this time apparently seeking some affirmation that this moment was real. I want to tell her that she's right, but I've completely lost the ability to speak. My expression, however, seems to offer the validation she's after. She nods her head slightly.
How? How, Adam? How could I know that?
I'm not sure if the question's rhetorical or if she thinks I have a clue to her metaphysical mystery. And I'm in no state to answer either way because I'm crying. I don't realize it till I taste the salt against my lips. I can't remember the last time I've cried, but once I accept the mortification of sniveling like a baby, the floodgates open and I'm sobbing now in front of Mia, in front of the whole damn world. Chapter 19. The first time I ever saw Mia Hall was 6 years ago. Our high school had this arts program, and if you chose music as your elective, you could take music classes or opt for independent study to practice in the studios. Mia and I both went for the independent study. I'd seen her playing her cello a couple of times, but nothing had really registered.
I mean, she was cute and all, but not exactly my type. She was a classical musician. I was a rock guy. Oil and water and all that. I didn't really notice her until the day I saw her not playing. She was just sitting in one of the soundproof practice booths, her cello resting gently against her knees, her bow poised a few inches above the bridge. Her eyes were closed and her brow was a little furrowed. She was so still. It seemed like she'd taken a brief vacation from her body. And even though she wasn't moving, even though her eyes were closed, I somehow knew that she was listening to music then, was grabbing the notes from the silence, like a squirrel gathering acorns for the winter before she got down to the business of playing. I stood there, suddenly riveted by her, until she seemed to wake up and start playing with this intense concentration. When she finally looked at me, I hustled away. After that, I became kind of fascinated by her, and by what I guessed was her ability to hear music in the silence. Back then, I'd wanted to be able to do that, too. So I took to watching her play, and though I told myself the reason for my attention was because she was as dedicated a musician as I was, and that she was cute, the truth was that I also wanted to understand what she heard in the silence. During all the time we were together, I don't think I ever found out. But once I was with her, I didn't need to. We were both music-obsessed, each in our own way. If we didn't entirely understand the other person's obsession, it didn't matter, because we understood our own. I know the exact moment Mia is talking about. Kim and I had driven to the hospital in Sarah's pink Dodge Dart. I don't remember asking Liz's girlfriend to borrow her car. I don't remember driving it. I don't remember piloting the car up into the hills where the hospital is, or how I even knew the way. Just that one minute I was in a theater in downtown Portland, soundchecking for that night's show, when Kim showed up to deliver the awful news. And the next minute, I was standing outside the hospital. What Mia inexplicably remembers, it's sort of the first pinpoint of clarity in that whole petri dish blur between hearing the news and arriving at the trauma center. Kim and I had just parked the car, and I'd walked out of the garage ahead of her. I'd needed a couple of seconds to gather my strength, to steel myself for what I was about to face. And I'd remembered looking at the hulking hospital building and wondering if Mia was somewhere in there, and feeling a heart and throat panic that she died in the time it had taken Kim to fetch me. But then I'd felt this wave of something. Not really hope, not really relief, but just a sort of knowledge that Mia was still in there. And that had been enough to pull me through the doors. They say that things happen for a reason, but I don't know that I buy that. I don't know that I'll ever see a reason for what happened to Kat, Denny, and Teddy that day. But it took forever to get in to see Mia. I got turned away from the ICU by Mia's nurses, and then Kim and I devised this whole plan to sneak in. I don't think I realized it at the time, but I think in a weird way, I was probably stalling. I was gathering my strength. I didn't want to lose it in front of her. I guess part of me somehow knew that Mia, deep in her coma, would be able to tell. Of course, I ended up losing it in front of her anyway. When I finally saw her the first time, I almost blew chunks. Her skin looked like tissue paper. Her eyes were covered with tape. Tubes ran in and out of every part of her body, pumping liquids and blood in and draining some scary-ass shit out. I'm ashamed to say it, but when I first came in, I wanted to run away. But I couldn't. I wouldn't. So instead, I just focused on the part of her that still looked remotely like Mia, her hands. There were monitors stuck to her fingers, but they still looked like her hands. I touched the fingertips of her left hand, which felt worn and smooth, like old leather. I ran my fingers across the nubby calluses of her thumbs. Her hands were freezing, just like they always were. So I warmed them, just like I always did. And it was while warming her hands that I thought about how lucky it was that they looked okay. Because without hands, there'd be no music. And without music, she'd have lost everything. And I remember thinking that somehow Mia had to realize that too, that she needed to be reminded that she had the music to come back to. I ran out of the ICU, part of me fearing that I might never see her alive again, but somehow knowing that I had to do this one thing. When I came back, I played her the Yo-Yo Ma, and that's also when I made her the promise that she's held me to. I did the right thing. I know it now. I must have always known, but it's been so hard to see through all my anger. And it's okay if she's angry. It's even okay if she hates me. It was selfish what I asked her to do, even if it wound up being the most unselfish thing I've ever done. The most unselfish thing I'll have to keep doing. But I'd do it again. I know that now. I'd make that promise 1,000 times over, and lose her 1,000 times over, to have heard her play last night, or to see her in the morning sunlight, or even without that, just to know that she's somewhere out there, alive. Mia watches me lose my shit all over the promenade. She bears witness as the fissures open up, the lava leaking out, this great explosion of what I guess to her must look like grief. But I'm not crying out of grief. I'm crying out of gratitude. Chapter 20. Someone wake me when it's over, when the evening silence softens golden. Just lay me on a bed of clover. Oh, I need help with this burden. Hush. Collateral damage, track 13. When I get a grip over myself and calm down, my limbs feel like they're made of dead wood. My eyes start to droop. I just drank a huge cup of insanely strong coffee, and it might as well have been laced with sleeping pills. I could lie down right here on this bench. I turn to Mia. I tell her I need to sleep. My place is a few blocks away, she says. You can crash there. I have that floppy calm that follows a cry. I haven't felt this way since I was a child, a sensitive kid, who would scream at some injustice or another until all cried out. My mother would tuck me into bed. I picture Mia tucking me into a single boy's bed, pulling the Buzz Lightyear sheets up to my chin. It's full-on morning now. People are awake and out and about. As we walk, the quiet residential area gives way to a commercial strip, full of boutiques, cafes, and the hipsters who frequent them. I'm recognized, but I don't bother with any subterfuge. No glasses, no cap. I don't try to hide at all. Mia weaves among the growing crowds and then turns off onto a leafy side street full of brownstones and brick buildings. She stops in front of a small red brick carriage house. Home sweet home. It's a sublet from a professional violinist who's with the Vienna Philharmonic now. I've been here a record 9 months. I follow her into the most compact house I've ever seen. The first floor consists of little more than a living room and kitchen, with a sliding glass door leading out to a garden that's twice as deep as the house. There's a white sectional couch, and she motions for me to lie down on it. I kick off my shoes and flop onto one of the sections, sinking into the plush cushions. Mia lifts my head, places a pillow underneath it, and a soft blanket over me, tucking me in just as I'd hoped she would. I listen for the sound of her footsteps on the stairs up to what must be the bedroom, but instead I feel a slight bounce in the upholstery as Mia takes up a position on the other end of the couch. She rustles her legs together a few times. Her feet are only inches away from my own. Then she lets out a long sigh, and her breathing slows into a rhythmic pattern. She's asleep. Within minutes, so am I. When I wake up, light is flooding the apartment, and I feel so refreshed that for a second I'm sure I've slept for 10 hours and have missed my flight. But a quick glance at the kitchen clock shows me it's just before 2 o'clock, still Saturday. I've only been asleep for a few hours, and I have to meet Aldous at the airport at 5. Mia is still asleep, breathing deeply and almost snoring. I watch her there for a while. She looks so peaceful and so familiar. Even before I became the insomniac I am now, I always had problems falling asleep at night, whereas Mia would read a book for 5 minutes, roll onto her side, and be gone. A strand of hair has fallen onto her face, and it gets sucked into her mouth and back out again with each inhalation and exhalation. Without even thinking, I lean over and move the strand away, my finger accidentally brushing her lips. It feels so natural, so much like the last 3 years haven't passed, that I'm almost tempted to stroke her cheeks, her chin, her forehead. Almost. But not quite. It's like I'm seeing Mia through a prism, and she's mostly the girl I knew, but something has changed. The angles are off, and so now the idea of me touching a sleeping Mia isn't sweet or romantic. It's stalkerish. I straighten up and stretch out my limbs. I'm about to wake her, but can't quite bring myself to. Instead, I walk around her house. I was so out of it when we came in a few hours ago, I didn't really take it in. Now that I do, I see that it looks oddly like the house Mia grew up in.
There's the same mismatched jumble of pictures on the wall. A velvet Elvis, a 1955 poster advertising the World Series between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees, and the same decorative touches, like chili pepper lights festooning the doorways. And photos, they're everywhere, hanging on the walls, covering every inch of counter and shelf space. Hundreds of photos of her family, including what seemed to be the photos that once hung in her old house. There's Kat and Denny's wedding portrait, a shot of Denny in a spiked leather jacket holding a tiny baby Mia in one of his hands. 8-year-old Mia, a giant grin on her face, clutching her cello. Mia and Kat holding a red-faced Teddy minutes after he was born. There's even that heartbreaking shot of Mia reading to Teddy, the one that I could never bear to look at Mia's grandparents, though somehow here, in Mia's place, it doesn't give me that same kick in the gut. I walk through the small kitchen and there's a veritable gallery of shots of Mia's grandparents in front of a plethora of orchestra pits, of Mia's aunts and uncles and cousins hiking through Oregon mountains or lifting up pints of ale. There are a jumble of shots of Henry and Willow and Trixie and the little boy who must be Theo. There are pictures of Kim and Mia from high school and one of the two of them posing on top of the Empire State Building, a jolting reminder that their relationship wasn't truncated. They have a history of which I know nothing. There's another picture of Kim wearing a flak jacket, her hair tangled and down and blowing in a dusty wind. There are pictures of musicians in formal wear holding flutes of champagne, of a bright-eyed man in a tux with a mass of wild curls holding a baton, and the same guy conducting a bunch of ratty-looking kids, and then him again, next to a gorgeous black woman, kissing a not-ratty-looking kid. This must be Ernesto. I wander into the back garden for my wake-up smoke. I pat my pockets, but all I find there is my wallet, my sunglasses, the borrowed iPod, and the usual assortment of guitar picks that always seem to live on me. Then I remember that I must have left my cigarettes on the bridge. No smokes, no pills. I guess today is the banner day for quitting bad habits. I come back inside and take another look around. This isn't the house I expected. From all her talk of moving, I'd imagined a place full of boxes, something impersonal and aseptic. And despite what she'd said about spirits, I wouldn't have guessed that she'd surround herself so snugly with her ghosts. Except for my ghost. There's not a single picture of me, even though Kat included me in so many of the family shots. She'd even hung a framed photo of me and Mia and Teddy in Halloween costumes above their old living room mantel, a place of honor in the Hall home. But not here. There are none of the silly shots Mia and I used to take of each other and of ourselves kissing or mugging while one of us held the camera at arm's length. I love those pictures. They always cut off half a head or were obscured by someone's finger, but they seem to capture something true. I'm not offended. Earlier I might have been. But I get it now. Whatever place I held in Mia's life, in Mia's heart, was irrevocably altered that day in the hospital 3.5 years ago. Closure. I loathe that word. Shrinks love it. Bryn loves it. She says that I've never had closure with Mia. More than 5 million people have bought and listened to my closure, is my standard reply. Standing here in this quiet house where I can hear the birds chirping out back, I think I'm kind of getting the concept of closure. It's no big dramatic before-after. It's more like that melancholy feeling you get at the end of a really good vacation. Something special is ending, and you're sad, but you can't be that sad because, hey, it was good while it lasted. And there'll be other vacations, other good times. But they won't be with Mia, or with Bryn. I glance at the clock. I need to get back to Manhattan, pack up my stuff, reply to the most urgent of the emails that have no doubt piled up, and get myself to the airport. I'll need to get a cab out of here, and before that, I'll need to wake Mia up and say a proper goodbye. I decide to make coffee. The smell of it alone used to rouse her. On the mornings I used to sleep at her house, sometimes I woke up early to hang with Teddy. After I let her sleep to a decent hour, I'd take the percolator right into her room and waft it around until she lifted her head from the pillow, her eyes all dreamy and soft. I go into the kitchen and instinctively seem to know where everything is, as though this is my kitchen and I've made coffee here 1,000 times before. The metal percolator is in the cabinet above the sink, the coffee in a jar on the freezer door. I spoon the rich, dark powder into the chamber atop the percolator, then fill it with water and put it on the stove. The hissing sound fills the air, followed by the rich aroma. I can almost see it, like a cartoon cloud floating across the room, prodding Mia awake. And sure enough, before the whole pot is brewed, she's stretching out on the couch, gulping a bit for air like she does when she's waking up. When she sees me in her kitchen, she looks momentarily confused. I can't tell if it's because I'm bustling around like a housewife, or just because I'm here in the first place. Then I remember what she said about her daily wake-up call of loss. "Are you remembering it all over again?" I ask the question, out loud, because I want to know, and because she asked me to ask. "No," she says. "Not this morning." She yawns, then stretches again. "I thought I dreamed last night. Then I smelled coffee."
"Sorry," I mutter.
She's smiling as she kicks off her blanket. "Do you really think that if you don't mention my family, I'll forget them?"
"No," I admit. "I guess not."
"And as you can see, I'm not trying to forget."
Mia motions to the photos.
"I was looking at those. Pretty impressive gallery you've got, of everyone." "Thanks. They keep me company."
I look at the pictures, imagining that one day Mia's own children will fill more of her frames, creating a new family for her, a continuing generation that I won't be a part of.
"I know they're just pictures," she continues, "but some days they really help me to get up in the morning. Well, them and coffee."
"Ah, the coffee." I go to the kitchen and open the cabinets where I know the cups will be, though I'm a little startled to find that even these are the same collection of 1950s and 60s ceramic mugs that I've used so many times before, amazed that she's hauled them from dorm to dorm, from apartment to apartment. I look around for my favorite mug, the one with the dancing coffee pots on it, and I'm so damn happy to find it's still here. It's almost like having my picture on the wall, too. A little piece of me still exists, even if the larger part of me can't. I pour myself a cup, then pour Mia's, adding a dash of half and half like she takes it.
"I like the pictures," I say. "Keeps things interesting."
Mia nods, blows ripples into her coffee.
"And I miss them too," I say.
"Every day."
She looks surprised at that. Not that I miss them, but I guess by my admitting it finally. She nods solemnly.
"I know," she says. She walks around the room, running her fingers lightly along the picture frames.
"I'm running out of space," she says. "I had to put up a bunch of Kim's recent shots in the bathroom. Have you talked to her lately?"
She must know what I did to Kim.
"No."
"Really? Then you don't know about the scandal?"
I shake my head.
"She dropped out of college last year. When the war flared up in Afghanistan, Kim decided, screw it, I want to be a photographer, and the best education is in the field. So she just took her cameras and off she went. She started selling all these shots to the AP and the New York Times. She cruises around in one of those burkas and hides all her photographic equipment underneath the robes and then whips them off to get her shot."
"I'll bet Mrs. Shine loves that."
Kim's mom was notoriously overprotective. The last I'd heard of her, she was having a freak out that Kim was going to school across the country, which Kim had said was precisely the point. Mia laughs.
"At first, Kim told her family she was just taking a semester off, but now she's getting really successful, so she's officially dropped out. And Mrs. Shine has officially had a nervous breakdown. And then there's the fact that Kim's a nice Jewish girl in a very Muslim country."
Mia blows on her coffee and sips.
"But on the other hand, now Kim gets her stuff in the New York Times, and she just got a feature assignment for National Geographic, so it gives Mrs. Shine some bragging ammo."
"Hard for a mother to resist," I say.
"She's a big shooting star fan, you know."
"Mrs. Shine? I always had her pegged as more hip-hop."
Mia grins.
"No, she's into death metal, hardcore. Kim, she saw you guys play in Bangkok. Said it poured rain and you played right through it."
"She was at that show? I wish she would have come backstage, said hi,"
I say, even though I know why she wouldn't have. Still, she came to the show. She must have forgiven me a little bit.
"I told her the same thing, but she had to leave right away. She was supposed to be in Bangkok for some R&R, but that rain you were playing in was actually a cyclone somewhere else, and she had to run off and cover it. She's a very badass shutter babe these days."
I think of Kim chasing Taliban insurgents and ducking flying trees. It's surprisingly easy to imagine.
It's funny, I begin.
What is?
Mia asks.
Kim being a war photographer, all danger girl.
Yeah, it's a laugh riot.
That's not how I meant. It's just Kim, you, me. We all came from this nowhere town in Oregon, and look at us. All three of us have gone to, well, extremes. You gotta admit, it's kind of weird.
It's not weird at all,
Mia says, shaking out a bowl of cornflakes.
We were all forged in the crucible. Now come on, have some cereal.
I'm not hungry. I'm not even sure I can eat a single cornflake. But I sit down, because my place at the Hall family table has just been restored. Time has a weight to it, and right now, I can feel it heavy over me. It's almost 3 o'clock. Another day is half over, and tonight, I leave for the tour. I hear the clicking of the antique clock on Mia's wall. I let the minutes go by longer than I should before I finally speak. We both have our flights. I should probably get moving, I say. My voice sounds far away, but I feel weirdly calm. Are there taxis around here?
No, we get back and forth to Manhattan by river raft, she jokes.
You can call a car, she adds after a moment. I stand up, make my way toward the kitchen counter where Mia's phone sits.
What's the number?
I ask.
718,
Mia begins. Then she interrupts herself.
Wait.
At first, I think she has to pause to recall the number. But I see your eyes, at once unsure and imploring.
There's one last thing,
she continues, her voice hesitant.
Something I have that really belongs to you.
My wipers t-shirt? She shakes her head.
That's long gone, I'm afraid. Come on, it's upstairs.
I follow her up the creaking steps. At the top of the narrow landing to my right, I can see your bedroom with its slanted ceilings. To my left is a closed door. Mia opens it, revealing a small studio. In the corner is a cabinet with a keypad. Mia punches in a code and the door opens. When I see what she pulls out of the cabinet, at first I'm like, oh right, my guitar. Because here in Mia's little house in Brooklyn is my old electric guitar, my Les Paul Jr. The guitar I bought at a pawn shop with my pizza delivery earnings when I was a teenager. It's the guitar I used to record all our stuff leading up to and including Collateral Damage. It's the guitar I auctioned off for charity and have regretted doing so ever since. It's sitting in its old case, with my old Fugazi and K-Records stickers, with the stickers from Mia's dad's old band, even. Everything is the same. The strap, the dent from when I dropped it off a stage, even the dust smells familiar. And I'm just taking it all in, so it's a few seconds before it really hits me. This is my guitar. Mia has my guitar. Mia is the one who bought my guitar for some exorbitant sum, which means that Mia knew it was up for auction. I look around the room. Among the sheet music and cello paraphernalia is a pile of magazines, my face peeking out from the covers. And then I remember something back on the bridge. Mia justifying why she left me by reciting the lyrics to Roulette. And suddenly, it's like I've been wearing earplugs all night and they've fallen out, and everything that was muffled is now clear, but also so loud and jarring. Mia has my guitar. It's such a straightforward thing, and yet I don't know that I would have been more surprised had Teddy popped out of the closet. I feel faint. I sit down. Mia stands right in front of me, holding my guitar by the neck, offering it back to me.
You?
Is all I can manage to choke out.
Always me,
she replies softly, bashfully.
Who else?
My brain has vacated my body. My speech is reduced to the barest of basics.
But why?
Somebody had to save it from the Hard Rock Cafe,
Mia says with a laugh. But I can hear the potholes in her voice, too.
But,
I grasp for the words like a drowning man reaching for floating debris.
You said you hated me.
Mia lets out a long, deep sigh.
I know. I needed someone to hate. And you're the one I love the most, so it fell to you.
She's holding out the guitar, nudging it toward me.
She wants me to take it, but I couldn't lift a cotton ball right now. She keeps staring, keeps offering.
But what about Ernesto?
A look of puzzlement flits across her face, followed by amusement. He's my mentor, Adam, my friend. He's married. She looks down for a beat. When her gaze returns, her amusement has hardened into defensiveness. Besides, why should you care?
Go back to your ghost, I hear Bryn telling me. But she has it wrong. Bryn is the one who's been living with the ghost, the specter of a man who never stopped loving someone else.
There never would have been a Bryn if you hadn't decided you needed to hate me, I reply.